Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here with us on Sunday morning wake-up call with Charlottesville tomorrow. Our guest is reporter Emily Hayes. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Emily is the reporter there, or work in journalism in India, right?
Mm-hmm.
Solo podcast Struggle for a Name about women who drove case and education reform in India.
Yeah.
In the 1980s.
Right. Yeah. It was less a case, more a movement to rename the university.
But. Yeah. Graduated in 2016 from Yale.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
A double major in history and South Asian studies.
Mm-hmm.
And a Charlottesville native and a graduate of Charlottesville High School.
Yeah, that's right.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
And welcome to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
So you've done a number of reports. You've been with Charlottesville Tomorrow for a year.
That's right.
And I like to have reporters from Charlottesville Tomorrow on every so often to talk about what's going on, because Charlottesville Tomorrow has its own website, Charlottesville Tomorrow, CVilleTomorrow.org.
That's right.
Reports are printed in
the Daily Progress. We have a partnership with them.
Also have a partnership with WTJU. Is
that
correct?
Right. That's right.
And some of the larger stories get noticed, but sometimes some of the stories, if you're living a daily life, a busy daily life, some of the ones that are sort of the building blocks of the big stories can get overlooked. And I like to devote an hour to the hard work of the reporters so that the stories can get noticed all the time.
I appreciate that.
And then some of them just make me laugh. Not that the stories are funny, that the writing is funny, that I'm like, come on, people, how do you think you can get away with this? Which will be one of the ones that I'm going to get into. But let's start with one of your articles. Albemarle County Board of Supervisors, a couple of these spots are up for election. Three positions are available coming up this year.
That's
in November,
yeah,
I believe,
in November
is when the elections are up.
Right.
And so far, this article is from January 20th.
Mm-hmm.
Three positions available, but so far, just one new candidate.
So there now have been two more since then, two for the Ravana seat. So like you said, there are three seats. That's Ravana, Scottsville, and Whitehall. For the Ravana seat, we have two Democrats contesting that election. The person who, the supervisor there, currently does not want to run again.
Norman Dill.
Exactly. Right. So those two candidates are Bay Lapisto-Kirtley and Gerard Smith.
Who's the first one?
Bay Lapisto-Kirtley.
Okay.
And then for Scottsville, Rick Randolph is not running again. And we have a Republican, Mike Hallahan, who is a defense attorney, interested in that spot.
Okay.
And then for Whitehall, Ann Malik has held that seat for a number of years, and she's running again.
All right. One thing that I noticed, Norman Dill, when he said that he was not going to run again, he made a quote, I believe in your article, said that in the future, the supervisor role may need to be paid more. It shouldn't have to be that only people that are independently wealthy can run. And I'm not wealthy at all. I lost a ton of money, lost a ton of income by not tending to my business.
Mm-hmm.
And he owns Rebecca's Natural Foods in Barracks Road. So you would think that the owner of that store would be somewhat wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I haven't looked into his exact income, but I think multiple supervisors have said that this is a huge time commitment. Rick Randolph had a similar reasoning for not wanting to run again. He said something like 50 to 60 hours a week. I don't know. You know, I haven't verified that either, but I think that it is a significant time commitment, even for me going to those meetings. Yeah. It's, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours on Wednesday, two times a month. So even that plus the prep work that they do for those meetings, very significant time commitment.
So what can you tell us about the folks who have announced their candidacy?
Yeah, so the new people that we're looking at are the two Democrats running for the Ravana seat and the one Republican running for the Scottsville seat. The two Ravana candidates, Miss Kirtley is moved here in 2007 from LA. She's held a number of positions in California, city council, various board positions, and she's interested in broadband, transportation, especially congestion along 29, affordable housing, healthcare, and schools were some of the issues that she cares about. Gerard Smith, he also cares about broadband. He mentioned affordable housing as well, but he's really focused on what he called dream infrastructure. So that's where broadband in rural areas becomes important. He's interested in a business-friendly environment and tech-focused schools and technical vocational schools.
And then you have the Republican individual down in Scottsville?
That's right, Mike Hallahan. He's the only Republican announced so far for either the city or the county. And he was focused on not raising taxes, maybe decreasing taxes, but he just generally was, you know, that's not the way to raise revenue for the county. He's more interested in bringing more jobs and citizens to the county to help raise that revenue.
And then Ann Malik in Whitehall has decided that she will run for a fourth term.
That's right. Yeah. She is a, you know, very seasoned politician in the county. She was chairwoman for until this recent sort of change of chairs. And, you know, she's very efficient. I can tell you that for sure. She said that some of the things she was proud of were there's a recent court agreement over whether the county would move its court out of Charlottesville. She was proud of that agreement, that working together between the city and the county. She's really focused on the environment, and so she's proud of some of the environmental protections she's put in place and the economic development program the county has implemented this recent year.
Has there been any rumor about the possibility of someone running against her?
Not that I've heard. So we'll see. I think she ran uncontested in 2015. So maybe people have just, you know, in the most recent, in a recent Board of Supervisors meeting, a number of different members of the public came up and said, I'm from the Ann Malik district. So she's definitely well known. She does a lot of town halls. So I can see why it might be challenging to run against her.
And those are the three districts that are open, right? Ravana, Scottsville, and Whitehall.
That's right.
Have you done any work on the Charlottesville area?
I didn't cover those. There were so many candidates coming out. One of Josh Mandel, who just left Charlottesville tomorrow to go live in Chicago, he was covering that. But I can tell you, there are a lot of candidates. There were five candidates who talked at a Democratic forum on Saturday, the 23rd, Saturday the 23rd. And there are two independent candidates who have announced so far, and then there are three current city councilors whose seats are up for election. None of them have said whether they are running.
That would be Kathy Galvin, mm-hmm. Mike Signer, and Wes Bellamy.
That's right.
And they still haven't announced whether or not they're going to run again.
Exactly. So it's been a tough, tough year for city council. There's been a lot of public scrutiny, very tense meetings sometimes, and go very late into the night. So I can see why. I don't know whether I would want to be in that environment for another term, but they might still feel like their work is unfinished. So we'll wait and see.
Do we know when those decisions might need to be made?
March 28th is the filing deadline for the primaries. Obviously, there are a number of Democratic candidates. So if all three who are up for re-election are Democrats, so they would have to register by March 28th. The primary would be June 11th, and that's the time when all independent candidates have to file by.
Okay. All right. So far in the Board of Supervisors, there's still possibility because there's no Democrat in the Scottsville district.
That's right.
And that would be quite a surprise in Albemarle County to not have a Democrat.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe all of the current Board of Supervisors, all the current supervisors are Democrats.
Again, our guest today is Emily Hayes. She's a reporter with Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find all the articles, and you can find Emily's specific articles at cvilletomorrow.org. Let's talk about the article that specifically made me roll my eyes in somewhat smile and also sort of disgust. You did an article back in December of last year that I had overlooked. It wasn't that you only wrote one or that only came out in one place in Seville Tomorrow. But Seville Tomorrow is the kind of place that brings this out first. And then others have to pick it up and carry it to a wider place. The headline was Albemarle County says Wendell Wood owes $150,000 for bus service. So start by explaining to everybody briefly. I think many people would know who Wendell Wood is, but why would Albemarle County say Wendell Wood? Who is Wendell Wood? Why would he owe the money?
So he's a developer. He developed part of the Hollymead Town Center, and he is the founder and owner of United Land Company, which is really responsible for a lot of what's happened along the 29 North.
If you see
corridor.
The signs, it's sort of a shield, like a knight's shield is the symbol that has a U and an LC on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably familiar from studying him now, what he did many years ago was he was smart enough. He went around Charlottesville at a much smaller time and bought land in a ring. And he just realized where Charlottesville was in terms of its growth. And he just bought acres and acres and miles of property around Charlottesville in circles so that as Charlottesville grew, people were going to have to be forced to buy land from him. And that was his business idea.
And it makes a lot of sense because that is how Albemarle has grown. It's in this ring around Charlottesville, and it has development areas, which are where all the people mostly live, and then there are rural areas outside of that.
Right. It didn't grow up, it grew out.
Exactly.
And so they expanded their belt and then were forced to buy from his ULC business,
mm-hmm.
and he held the land for them to buy from.
Yeah, and there are some other developers who are also did something similar, but
right.
He certainly isn't a very important force in what the area looks like.
So that's who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So why does Albemarle County say that Mr. Wood owes them $150,000 for bus service?
He contest. So there was a proffer agreement.
A proffer agreement.
Right. This is a way for the county to address some of the if a development happens, there are a lot of impacts, like on traffic, on, you know, maybe there are more children in the school. So the county needs some money and some resources to deal with that growth. And historically, counties and cities have relied on proffer agreements where the developer will offer some amount of money or some, you know, offer some land or something to help deal with the impacts
of
the development.
We'll change our rules for you if you give us some money for the impact you're going to have.
Right, right. I think you don't even need to change the rules. I'm not sure about that. But okay. Yeah.
Right.
So certainly in this case, it was a rezoning application way back, several years back. And then in 2016, Albemarle implemented a jaunt bus up 29 to Hollymead. And in the proffer agreement, it said that Wendell Wood would start paying for that bus service $50,000 a year. And he has contested that the bus is not for his development. It's for the suburbs or the neighborhoods north of the development. Because this is a Sears, I believe, it's a shopping center, he thinks that there aren't impacts of that development that would require a bus service. So he has said that this is unreasonable and he doesn't want to pay the $50,000 a year. So he hasn't, and the county is now like, this is $150,000 now that you owe. Where is it? And so... I think we'll see whether they decide to take it, whether Wendell Wood decides to take it to court, but that would be his next option because the county has decided he definitely does owe them this money.
But it wasn't just the argument about whether or not he owes the money,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the county saying you owe us $50,000 and you haven't paid it. Now it's year two and you owe us $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were some decisions made based on this, correct? I believe Jaunt came and had some decisions that they made based on the fact that this money was going to be incoming.
Right, right. They implemented the Jaunt service because they knew that this would pay for it.
Right.
So, yeah.
But there was also somebody was complaining that the bus service was being followed.
So passengers of the bus were concerned that there was a car sitting outside in the Hollymead Town Center watching who would come on and off. And this turned out to be developer Wendell Wood counting how many people were getting on and off at Hollymead and following the bus to see, where else people were getting off. In other words, who was this really serving? He was collecting his own data. But it definitely disturbed the passengers a little bit.
Right. They were, I think the word used reporting was somebody was tracking the bus.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't identify himself to anyone when somebody mm-hmm. finally had the nerve to come up
mm-hmm.
and ask what was going on. And so he still won't pay. And now he's, even though he accepted this rule once before, I believe $50,000 for 10 years?
Yeah. It was part of an agreement in the rezoning application. So.
Right. And so he got what he wanted, but now he won't give what he owes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he argues that there were various points when he didn't quite agree to this proffer agreement, but anyway.
Right. He got to be such a smart businessman by not recognizing and knowing what was in the details. Again, our guest today, Emily Hayes, she's a reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow, cvilletomorrow.org. We'll be right back. And here we are back on a Sunday here at WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, with our guest today, Emily Hayes, out of the office, off the beat, from Charlottesville Tomorrow. We have a whole list of articles that she's written that we're going to go through, try and catch you up to speed, tie some together. We've got some here on affordable living and planning that we're going to try and do in the next group. So before we get started, though, Emily, I want to know, what is it about affordable living that catches your eye?
Well, it is a huge topic right now, particularly in the city, a little bit less in the county. I think after August 12, 2017, people were thinking about race in a new way, and some of that momentum has pushed forward the affordable housing conversation. There's a lot of emotion and momentum in that conversation right now.
What is it about for you? I mean, we mentioned that you went to India and worked in a caste system. Well, so why, you could have come back, and I don't know that you could have picked anything you wanted to write on, but this seems to be of special interest to you.
Yeah, I am particularly interested in talking about race and class and how history has impacted where we are now. And I think affordable housing is a really, really interesting place to talk about that. How class is formed. So all of the people, you know, all of your neighbors that you walk around and see, how their position in society is affected by history. I think affordable housing is a big part of that.
Well, let's start and get you worked up with some of the articles you've written. You have one back in February of this year on how council requests fiscal feasibility study for public housing. And this is on where Charlottesville City Council asks Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority plan for a public housing redevelopment. And City Council voted unanimously to release over $900,000 in already appropriated funds to use for new uses required by the Housing Authority.
So these were funds that City Council had already given CRHA at various points, and those uses were a little bit outdated with what they're currently trying to do, just a little bit in wording most of the time. And one of the things City Council talked about when they decided to release those funds to the new uses was they were saying, we want to see a larger plan for public housing redevelopment. So the story behind that is public housing redevelopment has been a conversation for almost a couple of decades. And there's, I think, particularly after August 12th, but in recent years, there's been a lot of momentum in that conversation. Especially public housing residents and advocates have used that momentum to finally make redevelopment happen. There is a memorandum of understanding between the Housing Authority and Riverbend Development that was signed in January. So that means we have a developer to do the redevelopment. And the Public Housing Association of Residents wants to use this momentum to get something concrete done. So that is redevelopment of Crescent Halls and the South First Street ball field. These are properties already owned by CRHA. Crescent Halls is already an apartment. And So they want to, FAR wants to get that obvious construction in front of residents to say, look, after decades, we have something. You can trust us that we will make this happen because this construction is in front of you and you can see that your lives are about to get better. But city council is worried about this moving so quickly within a short period of time without a larger master plan. So that's part of why they asked for that when they released the funding.
Am I misreading this, or is there a disagreement between Councillor Kathy Galvin and Mayor Nakia Walker that Councillor Kathy Galvin says isn't the goal of the Housing Authority that is generating its own revenue so that they don't need so many contributions from the city over time, in which case we just need to see that plan? And then later in the quote, you have Mayor Nakia Walker supporting the larger master plan for South First Street. But was concerned about the council forcing public housing to be self-sustaining.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is... So both Councillor Galvin and Mayor Walker are very committed to affordable housing. They both really care about it and have cared about it for a long time. They have a bit of a disagreement, and I think this is a really interesting conversation going on right now of what does public housing look like next? And it's a little bit about... What is the mix of incomes going to look like? So public housing is currently, in some ways, pockets of poverty in the city. And that has associated, you know, not as much of a chance to network, to get better jobs. You know, various maybe resources haven't been allocated to those areas as much as to other neighborhoods. So there's a lot of worry about that pocket of poverty kind of model. And one solution is to mix incomes within one development, one apartment. So maybe you have public housing residents next to people who have, you know, $80,000 yearly income. Mayor Walker's critique of that is that that's similar to displacement. Similar to gentrification. If you have an apartment that was like a small neighborhood in a way, you know, you have people who know each other and they have a similar income, maybe similar expectations of similar cultures. And if you bring in people who maybe are higher income, maybe different racial background, that the people who have the higher income will be more powerful if they, for example, think that their neighbor is behaving in a way that's inappropriate, whereas maybe that's just part of the culture of, you know, maybe noise level. Maybe there's a culture of more noise than a higher income person might want. And so maybe the higher income person calls a noise complaint, calls the police or something like that. And that could cause displacement of that lower-income resident. So that's really what Mayor Walker is concerned about. And this is kind of an ongoing debate between those two and others.
Have you read Jordy Walker's work on the reimagining of Friendship Court?
Yeah, Jordy Yeager, yeah.
Yeah, Jordy Yeager.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Jordy. He's only been on the show like half a dozen times, including this topic.
Yes. Yes, we worked pretty closely with him on that. He freelanced for us on that, and I looked over it before it published. You know, did some less editing.
Yeah. He talked about that on this program a month or so ago about how bringing in the mixing the incomes might be where somebody called the other family and then family services would show up mm-hmm. and take somebody away because of how that family was behaving their child. And that's not how I behave my family, my children, et cetera.
Right. So yeah, that's exactly that same debate.
So how does that you know, when you talk about public housing, how do we, or what is the discussion about removing the pockets of poverty? Is it to give, to spend more money? I mean, is that what we're talking about here? If it's not to mix the incomes, is it to give more money?
Well, I think in, I'm not from trying Mayor to
approach, I'm not trying to approach this as though I don't want to spend more money and be that sort. I'm trying to understand it.
Right, right. Mayor Walker's perspective. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure either. I think that is some, I think she wants to approach it as maybe the pockets of poverty, maybe that's not the problem. Maybe it's how we treat those pockets of poverty. So like you said, maybe it's providing more resources. Maybe it's working on racism within the larger society. So so you could have a mostly black neighborhood that's not under-resourced because of other forms of structural inequality.
Sunday morning wake-up call here on WPVC. Our guest today, Emily Hayes. She is a reporter for Charlottesville Tomorrow. I'm Rick Moore, dude with a stuffy nose. Sorry for the sounds. We are talking about various articles and topics under affordable living and planning at the moment. Do we know where this stands? This article that I am going through was written on February 8th. Has there been anything follow-up since then?
Yeah. CRHA, and which is the Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority, and the Public Housing Association of Residents and River Bend Development are all in this agreement to redevelop public housing, starting with Crescent Halls and the South First Street ball field. And they are working constantly. They're constantly constant updates because they are submitting an application for funding in March. So there have been all sorts of updates, but that's really what they're focused on. And once that gets complete, they're going to start working on the master plan that City Council wanted them to do and the fiscal feasibility study.
Okay. as far as planning goes, you have another article here that's from a month earlier, from January 8th, that talks about the revitalization of Martin Luther King's neighborhood and how that offers lessons for Charlottesville. Talk about that for a moment and whether or not what lessons were offered and whether or not any lessons have been followed.
Well, I don't know about followed yet, but this was a really fun article for me to write because this Historic District Development Corporation, an Atlanta group, was founded by Coretta Scott King. So the person I was talking to knew Coretta Scott King really well. And so that made me kind of just a few steps removed from Dr. King. So that was pretty cool. But so this development corporation was started in Atlanta in the Sweet Auburn neighborhood. This was where Dr. King grew up, his boyhood home. And so Ms. King was really concerned with saving his home, making it a historic landmark, a sort of destination, and also saving the neighborhood around it, because that neighborhood helped inform his vision. He had experienced this center of black life in Atlanta, you know, tons of music, mixed income, but black because it was segregated. But right across the street, you might have white families. And so he grew up seeing some of what he talked about in what the future could look like. He had some of those moments of idealism in his childhood. So it's really interesting how they've preserved the neighborhood. I think it's almost a lesson in what we were just talking about of how do you do mixed incomes, because they did want to return it to a mixed income neighborhood. The reason why it wasn't still a mixed income neighborhood was that with desegregation when Black families could move outside of these neighborhoods, people with higher incomes who had didn't have any, couldn't go in suburbs, couldn't use those pools, had the opportunity to. So people, higher income families moved out of these historic neighborhoods a lot of the time. So to return that, they had a lot of really interesting tools that we could definitely implement here.
Was there anything that you listed in that article that was brought back to any specific folks in the Charlottesville area whether you presented them to anybody at the Piedmont Housing Alliance or any of the other organizations that said, oh, let me write that down, or that you work side by side with, that's out there and that sort of thing that you know are on the list or are being done that can't be done in 2 days.
Right. So I know that people went, this was a talk that was held, I believe, at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. And I think people who, I have heard people be influenced by that conversation. So, for example, there's the New Hill Development Corporation, was just founded very recently. It's a new nonprofit. And it kind of caught the public eye in November, I believe, when they, when the city council gave them $500,000 to do a small area plan and some financial literacy programs for the Star Hill neighborhood. So I have heard the founder of that, Yolanda Harrell, talk about Sweet Auburn's influence and this Atlanta CDC's influence, CDC being Community Development Corporation. She was interested in how they knew they were going to increase tax values. They were going to increase the value of the properties in that neighborhood because they were doing development and rehabilitation of different houses. So they put some measures in place to make sure that low-income property owners didn't get displaced, that they could still afford their taxes. And so she was talking about maybe that's something that could be implemented in Star Hill so that while the community articulates their vision for what they want that neighborhood to be, with particularly current residents of that neighborhood, that any increase in property values won't displace current low-income residents.
Again, our guest today, Emily Hayes from Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find her articles at cvilletomorrow.org. Let's take our second break. That way we can come back undisrupted for the last stretch as we talk about low-income housing, some planning priorities, and how the city hopes to address segregation with the plan update. Hang tight. And here we are back in action today. Thanks so much for being with us. Just like we thank Emily for being here with us today. Not everybody can take time on a Sunday because some people have to listen while they're doing things with their hands while you only juggle things, turn papers. CVilletomorrow.org, Charlottesville Tomorrow. Is the official name. Daily Progress prints some of your articles. What's it like to have your article printed in the Daily Progress?
Well, it's fun because there are people who don't go to our website or subscribe to our email list who get our articles through the Daily Progress. Yeah. So it's fun when, you know, a friend's dad is like, oh, here's another Emily Hayes article. I'm going to read this one. So it's fun.
So let's talk about one of those articles. How the city hopes to address segregation with plan update. I'm always interested to find out how an organization thinks a plan is going to solve segregation. So tell me how that's going to happen.
It's about using class as a way to address race because race and class are so connected in our city and county. There are really interesting ways to look at this. Like, there's the Opportunity Atlas. You can look that up online. You can zoom in on different neighborhoods and who lives where in terms of race and what kind of class that has allowed, what class they had in childhood and what that neighborhood allowed them to be as adults. So where you live is really important to who you can grow up to be, what you can grow up to do. And in some of the neighborhoods in Charlottesville, it has been only available to wealthier families because of this thing that the plan is trying to address. And that is single family zoning. So this is the idea that you are only allowed to build houses that look like your, you know, one family lives in that house. Maybe you think of the Greenbrier neighborhood as an example of that, or North Downtown. And these are neighborhoods that through this larger, you know, kind of house, only allow wealthier families to live there. And that has sort of aligned with where people were allowed to live racially. So those were neighborhoods that were intended for white families starting in about the 1930s. And that's kind of carried through today. So some of these planners are hoping to address that history, that those original intentions in something that seems kind of boring and benign like zoning.
So you make it illegal to build duplexes, right? And is that just all it is, or can you make, I'm going to make, and I shouldn't say it because it makes like it sound I'm making fun of this problem, but can they just make duplexes nicer looking? I mean, because that's part of it. You don't want this ugly house in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Is it because you don't want two people living in that house? Is that it? Is it a religious / moral thing? Or is it you don't want that ugly house in your neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that is a way that it can be a barrier to that kind of denser housing. People get really worried about more people moving into their neighborhood. Everybody gets worried about change in their neighborhood. Literally everybody in the city is worried about that. But one of the ways that planners have been able to accommodate new people moving into the various cities is by making, like you said, some of these denser forms of housing that allow more families to live there to look basically like the housing next door. That requires some creative zoning, which is what the Planning Commission, the Charlottesville Planning Commission that's working on this plan we've been talking about, the comprehensive plan for Charlottesville, which has to be updated every 5 or so years. They are thinking about that. They're thinking about height restrictions and that sort of thing in these lower density neighborhoods.
I saw where it was advocated to increase density next to the University of Virginia because students are spilling further and further, farther and farther, mm-hmm. proper use of the word, away from UVA. It's not because they want to live farther and farther from UVA, but because there's nowhere else for them to go.
Yeah. It was that Rory Stolzenberg who said
that? I think
that?
So, yes.
Yeah. So he's a planning commissioner, and he was a UVA student at one point, and so he has this sort of, as were many people, I'm sure, kind of internal perspective on where students want to live, and he says they usually don't have cars, so they want to live closer into the university, but there's just not a place for them to live. So he's been advocating even actually the community as a whole has advocated for some more housing close in.
Right. I mean, if you look at several of the Charlotte. If you were to look at the university in Charlottesville from above, I think people would be surprised as to which neighborhoods have been selected and which neighborhoods have not, and now which neighborhoods are turning over. Fifeville would be 20 right. years ago, would be a neighborhood that was a poorer neighborhood and now is turning over. But it's as much because of the university as it is for anything else.
Right, right. Students definitely live in those neighborhoods close by, sort of the Grady Avenue area definitely has a lot of students. Fifeville also is a huge majority of residents there have moved in the last 30, even 20 years. And it definitely has an impact on those neighborhoods, whereas some of the farther away neighborhoods that have single-family zoning, like we've been talking about, haven't really changed. So that is definitely some of what the Planning Commission is talking about in this comprehensive plan.
Again, our guest today, Emily Hayes, talking about some of her articles that you can find on SeavilleTomorrow.org. That article can be found under the headline, City Hopes to Address Segregation with Plan Update. And one of the things is consequence, according to City Planning Commission, is unaffordable housing and segregation. And so that's the concern, is that it becomes unaffordable.
Right. You don't have space for more housing. You literally cannot build more housing in some of these neighborhoods. So they're trying to allow, you know, if someone wanted to divide up their property and put two houses on or put a duplex or something like that.
Is there concern of driving away some of the lower income families?
I think people are really worried about lower income families not having anywhere to live in the city, because as higher income families or individuals move in or, you know, want to get housing, they can pay more for housing. And so lower income families that maybe would have competed for that same spot now can't afford to compete with the higher income.
Or to some, what the sort of investors that we talked about earlier in the show may come in and make what seems like a lot of money to many lots in that neighborhood, and someone of a poor dollar may say, oh, you're going to offer me that for my house? I'll take that. And so they sell it, and then when they go to buy something new, they can't find that anywhere, and they need to move out to a county, and then they have a transportation issue or some other problem that shows up.
Right, right, definitely. I think they're really interesting components to that as well, of in some cases, maybe families aren't, it might be that the person who owns that home is actually very elderly and their children don't want to live in Charlottesville. So why don't their children want to live in Charlottesville? I think there are some interesting components to that problem as well.
You have an interesting story here. Local income housing organizations collaborate to win national grant.
Yes. So that was a grant by the Kresge Foundation, which was started by the same person who founded Kmart, or the same family. And that's a new collaboration between five different organizations. And it's kind of a new thing for Charlottesville to have such collaboration within the affordable housing world, especially the low-income housing world. So those organizations are Piedmont Housing Alliance, which does Friendship Court, CRHA, which we've been talking about, does public housing, FAR, the Public Housing Association of Residents, Habitat for Humanity, and the UVA Equity Institute. And so they're working on resident-led redevelopment in a way that's very innovative across the country. there aren't that many places that have. It's really a new thing, which is kind of crazy. I mean, you would think that most people kind of get some say in what housing they get, and you know, public housing residents and various low income residents haven't gotten that say in the past. So, but anyway, they all have slightly different models that they're working with and are trying to develop those models with the grants and provide training for resident leaders.
You had a comment here from a professor, UVA professor, who studies race, poverty, and public health. When people who live in neighborhoods that are unhealthy participate in the redevelopment of those neighborhoods, their mental health changes.
Exactly. So this is, that's her, part of her own research is about that. And this grant was about housing and health and was looking exactly for this, these kind of models that these organizations are doing.
It's fascinating. You know, when I look for a new house, and I'm not trying to turn this on me, but I always, you know, I've told my wife that one of the key things is I have to find a place that is, it has to be special in some way. You know, it has to have something that when you come home from work, it has to have some sort of oomph to it. You know, to replenish you, to reinvigorate you, to, you know, whatever. And so I can see that. People don't think about that. But I that's why I mentioned that about that, you know, duplexy, same on the outside thing in my neighborhood. You know, I can't live in that. And I can understand why the house needs the mental health.
Yeah, I definitely feel that way too. Yeah, it's really interesting to see the various choices, because I'm tracking all of these projects, that various low-income housing projects with a lot of resident leadership. It's interesting to see what kind of choices they're making. For example, in Friendship Court, an original plan back in 2016 was going to replace Friendship Court with a lot of big apartments, and families there didn't like that idea. They were used to sort of more of a duplex style, where they all have their own front door. And so residents said, no, we really want a front door. We can have some apartments because we want to accommodate more people into this small amount of land, but we want some to be more of this town home style of apartment, where you have your own front door and a little bit more space to yourself.
Right. Again, Emily Hayes from Charlottesville Tomorrow, talking about a lot of the work that she has done with affordable living and planning here in the last two-thirds of our hour. Some work that needs to be promoted and noticed. And so if you haven't had a chance to read it in depth, you can go back on cvilletomorrow.org and give these articles some little more in-depth than even we're giving them today. There's an article from back in January when we talk about affordable living and housing. Committee to present estimates for costs of solving the housing crisis. Back then, and this goes back a little over a month, where Patchum, sorry, Dave Norris, had all 65 beds full. The Salvation Army, which has like 48 beds or 40 plus beds, had all their beds full.
Right.
They were bringing people into their warming room. And
the warming room, to be clear, is not, there aren't really beds there. You have to kind of sleep sitting up.
You sit in a chair in a room that has a HVAC system.
Right.
Effectively. I'm curious as to what you found in that article. Increasing shelter capacity isn't enough?
Right. So something that Anthony Harrow said in that article, and he's the head of the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless, he was saying increasing shelter capacity isn't enough. We want a more permanent solution. And so rather than having these beds that, you know, in some cases are only open over the winter, which is huge for some people, but it would be better to have like actually a place to live, you know, a place to call your own. And very exciting, that is being talked about. I don't know if you know about the crossings on 4th and Preston. That's been around for a while. That's 60 single room apartments.
It's across from the Bodos. Preston's right. At the trail tracks, if you're not familiar.
Exactly. And 30 of the 60 rooms are dedicated to people who were formerly chronically homeless. Over multiple years, maybe they had experienced homelessness, or over a full year. So basically, they're talking about doing another one of those on Avon Street, next to the Belmont Bridge, where Community Bikes is now. They're definitely talking about, you know, doing something with maybe 50 single room apartments for the formerly chronically homeless and 30 for other folks, other low income or various incomes. So that could end chronic homelessness. The crossings already was a huge step for Charlottesville. You can see in the numbers how that decreased people who were staying in shelters. But a second one could do it for Charlottesville. In the last count, there were 41 people who were chronically homeless in 2018. And this is proposing 50 beds. So it could be huge.
Can you tell me about the intervention analysis tool?
Yeah, so the idea is working backwards from how much do we need? How much of different kinds of housing do we need? And plugging in numbers for that is basically an Excel spreadsheet created by the housing experts in town. And like how much money it costs for this kind of housing. So you plug in the numbers and then it spits out how much money you have to spend on it, especially how much does the city have to spend on it. This is really interesting at this point in time because the city is going through a budget process, trying to figure out how much to set aside to build new affordable housing in the next year. And I think part of why this intervention analysis tool was developed was there was a concern not enough money was being set aside.
And this type of intervention versus that type of intervention, I mean, they've determined that one is better than another?
Basically, there are such a variety of people, obviously, who are low income, who would need affordable housing. So a certain number would need this kind and a different number would need this kind. So it gets down to that kind of detail.
All right. So just a short few seconds left. What's your article that's going to be coming out? What are your articles in March?
Oh, I don't know yet. It all depends on what happens. But I will be covering affordable living and land use. Those are my beats. So.
Okay. So again, Emily Hayes from Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find Charlottesville Tomorrow at seavilletomorrow.org. You can search Emily with all her articles there. You can go back and find the things we've talked about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hope That's you'll come on fun. Again in the future.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We will have the book festival on in the future, along with other topics that catch our eye. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.